Our visit this hour is an interesting mix of something like urban planning and folk music, because on the table is a book called What I Found in a Thousand Towns. In the book, author Dar Williams shares what she's learned from years on the road in a thousand towns about what makes some of them work and some of them not feel like real communities. Dar Williams is simultaneously easy to categorize as a singer-songwriter and at the same time hard to categorize because she's interested in and does so much. She writes without music and she's an advocate for environmental and social justice. Let's get into the discussion with some music. There's the note of optimism. The world is not falling apart, at least because of me. You'll find a similar tone in the book. The full title is What I Found in a Thousand Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. Dar Williams, pleasure to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Nice to be here.
You start right off with your concept, positive proximity. Proximity of what to what?
Of us to each other. That's a good question. That's the basis. That was the aha moment. A friend of mine said, what do you think determines relationships in our communities, in our towns? And I said, you know, politics, values, hobbies. Like, no. And he said, it's just proximity. And I thought, there can be negative proximity, especially with a certain narrative that tells us that we have negative proximity, that your neighbors are people who look in you through your windows and whose dogs do terrible things to your lawn. But the truth is, communities that work or towns that I would call communities are ones that where people recognize that their proximity to one another is a positive force, that you want to be around other people because they've got the skill sets and the interests and the life that you can bring to the commons together to have a real working place where you feel happy to live, where you belong.
As opposed to a place where you go because you just want to get away from it all and you don't want to be bothered by anybody, you're not probably going to get a whole lot of community out of a bunch of people who move to a place for those reasons.
Right. And so that, you know, people are very cautious. You know, they say, are you trying to create one kind of town that has a coffee shop and a yuppie town that's going to gentrify really fast? And no, it's just, I'm interested in towns that become themselves. And sometimes when too much convenience is offered, i.e. it's a very wealthy town, you really are in danger of having everything that you want within your own four walls and never venturing out and then going online and getting very paranoid and thinking that everybody's a bunch of, that they're idiots. But there are some wealthy towns where people have figured out how to get into the commons and pour their wealth into the commons. So, yes, it's a wonderful thing to see people saying, I'm so proud to live here, and pointing to other people and buildings and parks and saying, this is a part of who I am.
You give a sample early in the book, A Sled Hill for Kids, which kind of reminds me of those old movies where, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney used to say, hey, let's put on a show. And
right.
Like, hey, we have a hill here for sledding. Let's do some sledding. And everything grows around that. Have you seen something like that in your town or that town you know?
We saw it in our school. We had a phenomenon. We had a local paper that was very mean. But it was run by the wife of Roger Ailes, who was the CEO.
This is the Hudson Valley of New York. I remember reading about this.
Right.
Yeah.
He was the CEO of Fox News. And a lot of those tactics of, personal attacks against people and humiliation of people and intimidation of people happened. But they kind of left the school alone. And our school, when we got there, was lovely. It was small as a public school, and there was a lot of nurturing of students and students in K through 12. So it was already lovely. But all these parents came, and they didn't want to get involved with the town because the paper would attack you if you got involved with local government. So somebody started a school garden. And other people got involved, people who had never gardened before. And this guy brought the bricks and this woman brought the fencing and people had suggestions. My husband and I donated the seeds. We went online and found what they wanted. And then they had a chef in the classroom who would cook the stuff with the kids. And they had a maze the kids could go through and a Dr. Seuss garden and a medicinal historical garden part. And so that got, and then other parents felt, competitive with that. And they're like, we don't have green thumbs, but we're computer people. So they created a computer makerspace. And we're seeing kids going off to Yale and Harvard now. the school got very good. And I said, I joked and said, I feel like our school is a private school disguised as a public school to siphon funds from the state because it has that feel. And somebody else came along and said, well, as long as we're being so sophisticated and groovy, let's get a ton of solar panels. And so the school is covered with solar panels. And so that looking at what other people were doing, seeing how people had that motivation, motivated other people, and suddenly, cohesively, the school became a much more interesting, forward-looking 21st century place, adding on to the wonderfulness that it already had.
Each idea built upon the one before it, and people got to use their skills, which gets us into the three major approaches that you talk about. You need to have spaces, start with spaces to be together, have projects to build identity, and there's translation of people's gifts. That's the one that requires probably the most explanation. Translation?
Translation, yeah, that's the hardest one. But because it's a feeling in the air, there's a sense of people being sort of open, having open palms as opposed to clenched fists, that there's a sense of wanting to bring your talents and skills to the commons, and also a desire to widen the points of access so that people can find their way in, and an understanding that the more points of access to the diversity of your town and the diversity of the people you have, the more paradoxically you're going to feel like a community, even though you think being homogeneous would feel more like it. No, the more cool that fabric is, the more you're going to love that feeling of community. So that's translation. It can be physical translation of signs, you know, and good media, like you have here at the Exchange. And it can be just the attitude that people have that working in the commons and being involved with things like local government isn't an opportunity for blame and finger pointing. It's an opportunity to have a better way of life.
Growth and building and making community out of just a place to live.
Right, right.
It gets bigger than that. The book is called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. Dar Williams is the traveling musician and the author of the book. We'll put her in the music chair and listen to some songs from her when we come back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dar Williams. You know her as a folk singer and songwriter. She writes about a lot of other things, too, and has a completely prose work out called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. So Dar Williams, in the course of traveling through the country, has observed a lot of human behavior in a lot of towns where things work and towns where they don't necessarily work and could stand a little help as well. Since Dar Williams is a singer and songwriter, we have set up another corner of the room so she can actually do some singing of her songwriting. And so before we get back to talk about the book, why don't we throw it over to Dar Williams in that position?
Thank you. All right, this is called Road Buddy, and it's a song I wrote when I was recognizing that there was a somewhere to find, you know, for myself and for others, but was also experiencing sort of the generic aspects of the landscape and realizing that I and others could dig deeper. And I wrote this for Sherman Alexie and the movie Smoke Signals. And I just have to say, he's got a great memoir out, and everybody should go find that. We passed the stores, we passed the hotels, filled our car with gas and then we drove that night, I saw the moon, almost got us in an accident. And then at the rest stop, when that woman tried to steal my wallet, it felt like an adventure. Isn't that what you would call it? Isn't that what you would call it? You're my road buddy, but I'm lonely all the time. Thought that we'd be laughing, having long talks on late night driving, but your drive's so bad I lost my patience. So pass the chips and turn the station. This is not a romance with the road.
where the moss grows up the trees and where the dirt is rusty red. I thought we'd find your story like a snake skin or an arrowhead, but we only stop at fast food places. They hate their jobs, I understand. I try to act familiar, but they're floating just above the land. And we are floating. And you're my road buddy, but I'm lonely all the time. I thought we'd show the friendship could be stronger than the crossroads devil, but I thought I heard the tall man sing, I'll take that thing you got from praying. This is not a romance with the road. And those cliffs are the same as in the magazines I had at home. And the tall grass reminds me of the same dreams I had at home. I thought life was a road and I wanted to begin it. I said my friend and I are going on a trip, so I can only stop a minute. You go to the vending machines. I want to watch these kids with their mother sipping on their juice boxes and smiling at each other. And yeah, but maybe that's their dad on the phone saying, hey mom, you shouldn't wait. Go ahead, have dinner, cause we're running just a little late. But we're on our way. Well, how about it, road buddy, yeah. I heard about the boxcars and the family of travelers, but there's real estate signs in the cornfield stubble. I know there's love, I bet there's trouble, but you just can't spend a lifetime from the road. And there's something I finally faced. I finally think I come from someplace. This is not a romance with the road. Oh no.
The song is Road Buddy, Dar Williams here on the Jefferson Exchange, not just talking about music and not just singing, but also talking about people she's met across the country in many, many towns. Her book is called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop Dog Run and Open Mic Night at a Time. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The case studies are so interesting in here. Moab, Utah, which is Trey Cool now, had some really hard times to get to where it is at this point. So, I mean, uranium was mined near there, and then there was something else it did to gain itself some fame.
There was oil and gas exploration, mm-hmm. And also, well, Edward Abbey was there, and he was a ranger at the Arches National Park, but that was not what we consider the national parks to be right now. So that is their claim to fame. I don't know if it was at the time. It really was just rough and tumble uranium town. There was a lot of camaraderie from what I heard. It was just a very, you know, factory town, as it were.
But didn't it also go into some competition for like the best dump in the country?
Yeah, yes. So, well, that was the transition point. And the story was told to me. Yeah, I was on the edge of my seat because there they were. You know, there's Joe Knightley telling me about how, you know, the town emptied out so quickly after the uranium bust that he saw wild animals crossing the street outside his office window. And then they have this town meeting, and it's very touching because they say, what are we going to do? And everybody shows up, and it's standing room only. And this guy says, well, you know, you do have these national parks. You could do tourism. And everybody laughed. They said, tourism? And Joe explained to me that Moab in the Bible is the last stop before hell. He said, so we didn't really think tourism. And the guy said, hey, this place is so beautiful. Even your garbage dump is beautiful. And Joe said that they went back and they talked about it and with this, you know, sort of council, this tourist board, as it were, and Chamber of Commerce. And they went and created what they called the most scenic dump contest. And they basically were running it with Grand Junction, which was also feeling very left out by Denver in Colorado. they both felt very alienated from their governments. And so somebody in the news wire picked it up and brought it to Denver. Then Denver printed it, and then suddenly you had Paris and Geneva and all these places competing for the scenic dump. And so they took a breath in Moab and they made it very funny. And Joe said, I already know who's won the most scenic dump, but we will have a contest for the second most scenic dump. And they did this whole thing, and it got all this attention. They were on the cover of Outside Magazine, and then Charles Kuralt came with his On the Road series, and he sets up this beautiful morning where the camera comes down from the sky, and there's snow coming off the mountain, and it comes down, and there's pine trees, and then the dump. And so they made it into this huge thing, after which they brought, they had everybody voting in town, and they brought the winner down from Kodiak, Alaska. And the mayor of Kodiak, Alaska came down and accepted this thing, which was a giant chrome garbage truck on a beautiful mahogany plank donated by Tonka. I mean, it was just so wonderful, and it was humorous, and it was easygoing, and when it got popular, they didn't freak out. They just made it more fun, and they rolled with it. And then Moab suddenly, with the help of a lot of other people, sort of came into its own as a tourist destination. And now they have 1.5 million people there coming through, and that's kind of an issue.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
7,500 person town and 1.5 million people coming through. Yeah.
Okay, so we can't all be located close to national parks or have the most scenic dump in the world, but cafes are pretty easy, and they sit atop your list of places. We talked about the fact you need places for people to be together, projects to build identity, and translation. But the places, cafes, seems pretty easy.
Well, I would also add that around here, that kind of natural beauty is also quite accessible. And so
yes,
how you can make
indeed
yourselves as towns the gateways to these places and kind of pull in your economies and identities into those places can be, profitable and also meaningful to your children. Sort of, this is who we are. We are the gateway to this wonder. But yes, cafes are, I fear that people think of cafes as being very sort of bourgeois, but, they can be very simple. But I do point out in the book things that I found that work, like having an extra room. I mean, if you have a little space and you have an extra room, it doesn't have to be glamorous. But that's where kids have privacy to write in their journals and not feel like somebody's going to kick them out. I think that's valuable. People can have intense private conversations. They can have a few people. Then you can have poetry readings. You can have concerts. So an extra space is good. Friendly people who work there, it's really important. It helps get people started thinking about it as a community space when you have community-minded people at the cash register. A toy corner is really great because parents are usually are just walking address books of all these different kinds of people that they have to interact with every day. Once they start to combine those information networks while they're watching their kids play, sometimes towns really benefit from all of that, the strength of weak ties, as they say, as Mark Granovetter coined the term. All these weak ties of acquaintances start to tie themselves up when you have kids able to play off in the corner. And the last thing is to allow that big bulletin board of community events and local art and all those things that you see in cafes happen, because that reminds you that there's a there, that you are where you are, and this is your town. It pulls people out and gets them curious about where they live. It doesn't have to be fancy schmancy with $6 lattes. It can really just be a community space that serves coffee, but that's proud of itself.
Well, I'm struck too by the, and it's not someone that it's overtly said throughout the book, but the concept that it's not about getting together to talk about the things that you differ on, the things like politics or which sports team you love or hate. And isn't it interesting how sports and politics are kind of like that, in the way that people are like, no, never, yes, always. But the fact that you find that you share a community, and that alone gives you something in common.
Right. And so the more the projects part of the book is to say, dig into something that's interesting to you, because maybe that's interesting to somebody else, and it will give you an, you know, it'll give you this common ground, whether it's just planting local flowers that are, you know, native to this area. There's a lot of beautiful, very native, very specific flowers to this region. Or if it's digging into the history, you know, the prehistory, what we call prehistory, the Native American history, the colonial history. So, you know, those things bring us to automatically talking about things that we share, and then they pull us into being more interested in the things that we share. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I found. The other thing to avoid besides things that divide you are concepts. I find when people say, let's just do this to build community, it actually puts my teeth on edge. Because, you know, there was a friend of mine.
So you want them to build community but not say it?
Yeah. A friend of mine was talking about a community dinner that they had in the town, and it was sort of like they were all sitting down and looking at each other and feeling that community thing. And I just thought, there's a certain kind of person who is attracted to that, so that's all automatically going to be kind of homogeneous. And it's not, you know, for me, community has a feeling, it's kind of like, you know, wheat bread, like there's little seeds in it, and there's little, maybe a little rock here and there. There's eccentric people who come into the community conversation. I had a hypothetical guy who rants that everybody's a fascist at town's meetings, but everybody loves him because they just knew, you know, he dropped a lot of acid once upon a time, but he taps everybody's maple trees and he makes maple syrup and gives it out. Like that is community, but I think sometimes people think of community as these sort of smoothly flowing abstractions of joy and peace. It's better than that. It's more gristy than that. So by going into projects, we find all of these different voices, and we don't just look at each other and go, ah, this is community. It's rougher and more grappling than that.
Well, and I'm struck, too, when you talk about the dinner, is that you're not talking about doing the same activity all at the same time, because the fact is, if you provide a place where people can dance over here, read over there, you know, talk to each other in a different corner, then they're together, but they're not necessarily doing the same thing. They're not required to do the same thing.
Yeah, I call this my post-Aquarian contribution to society. So, you know, you had the Age of Aquarius and people said, you know, this harmony and love. And I kind of feel like that's an outcome of giving people all the different nooks and crannies and spaces to participate in community life on their own terms. So, yes, absolutely. I think that, and at the same time, when our town felt like it was in trouble, I thought, well, what's the common denominator of our town? And I thought, tomatoes. So if I really could dig in, it would be to have a tomato festival, because all the foodies, all the gardeners, all the green thumbs, and all of the Italian immigrants who have very strong feelings about what you're supposed to grow and not grow, they all find this common ground. And that's valuable as well. But you got to really make sure you're cross-pollinating left and right and bring in the PTA and the vegans and the and the restaurants and the fire company. I was thinking we can make it a fundraiser for the fire company. You know, just always branching out for all that, those different points of access. Again, let's not just look at each other and enjoy the abstraction. Let's get into what makes things special down to our dirt.
Dar Williams, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is What I Found in 1,000 Towns. One of those thousands is Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, which you seem to come back to as something of a quasi-favorite. What did the people there do?
Well, they used to work in the steel mill. And actually, I think it's important to, there's an asterisk on this, which is that 17,000 people worked at the steel mill, and it practically closed overnight, as these things did do. It was really sudden. And there are about 3,000 plus people working in the local economy, which is a wonderful thing, an expression of something, what I call two-story commerce, you know, downstairs merchants, upstairs chiropractors. And but when we talked to an urban economist about this, we said, what happened to the other 14,000 people? And he didn't really have an answer. It's like, well, they, you know, retired. And so that question about what happens when the industrial downturn happens is still in the air. However, what Phoenixville did, it went down fast. One guy said, well, it's really where I got my drugs. You know, that's how it was. And somebody said it was a place you avoided. They did these. One of the things that they did, this group of people came in and said, no, we want to we want to bring this back. And they turned it into a historic district. They got a historic district status. So that was kind of an organizational coup. Then they started to fill up those historical buildings with, sort of businesses and things that referred back to the history, the proud history, the part that they wanted to keep, because there are plenty of unproud histories in every town. And they started to, present the glory and the story of the history of Phoenixville. And one of the things they also brought back was this old theater called the Colonial, where The Blob had been partially filmed. There was a scene in The Blob.
Old movie. The 50, was it 57?
58. Mm-hmm. Good for you. And there's a scene where Steve McQueen comes into the Colonial Theater to his friends, and he's like, I got to tell you something. There's this thing. It's a blob. And his friends are like, be quiet, man. It's like terrible acting. Like, be quiet, man. We're trying to watch the movie. And he's like, I'm telling you. And then the blob starts to come through the vent system, and everybody looks up and they scream and they leave the Colonial Theater. Well, the Colonial Theater was turned into a people's theater. It turned into a nonprofit where the community owned the theater, and they filled it with the community. And one of the things they filled it with was a blob fest where they celebrate sci-fi every July. And it's huge. So they went back to their history, and now everybody wants to live in Phoenixville because they do stuff like that.
So were they doing it to get more people into town, or just doing it to make themselves happy and feel prosperous?
Well, you know what's nice? It's always a combination. It's always a combination. And it worked in both directions. And it's just, everybody who hears about Phoenixville, like, they've got that blob fest. And they make a different theme every year with, science fiction from Japan. I went during Godzilla Week. And out of that have come other community projects and other sources of pride. So, it always grows.
All right. More coming up from What I Found in 1,000 Towns with Dar Williams, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, this is our final segment. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and thank you for listening. This is the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're talking to Dar Williams, the folk singer, songwriter, well-traveled musician who has been observing what goes on in the towns around her when she travels across the country. She's written a book called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking during the break about the fact that we here in the state of Jefferson live in a place that like Moab, Utah, which I notice you're going to in a couple of days, has really great physical beauty around. I mean, great attractions that people will want to come to. But I noticed, coming back to the example of Moab, that the mayor says, we do things for the people who live here. How hard can that be, though, to try to make sure that you're doing good things to the people who are always there while trying to attract people who are not?
I think that the mayor of Moab had the right idea, and I hope that that's a model that people can look at. Because when you've got a natural wonder that doesn't by itself, I mean, you go and you look at it and you hike up it and you fill your water bottle and that's free. All you can hope for is that people will buy a lot of postcards and that you'll get the revenue from the hotels and those things. But if it's a national chain, you really have to make sure that the fact that, your town is serving beer and burgers to these people, that you don't just become their servants, that their presence is enriching your life experience. And he really paid attention to that. And he said, our library will be the library that the tourists can find. And our parks will be the parks that the tourists can find. And let's make sure that we're paying attention to ourselves first and have the urban planning that pays attention to our citizens. And, there's a dividend of that, which is that as a tourist, I go and tourist sort of sounds like locust, it sounds like something that's just going to eat a bunch
swarms,
of stuff and be sort of invasive. But actually as a traveler, I love feeling that feel of what is happening in a town. I love feeling the green space at the commons. And so by helping your community, you're helping people come in and understand who you are and appreciate you as a community and think, how can I support your bookstore and the independent clothing stores? If I'm going to be spending all those tourist disposable income dollars, how can I do it in a way that appreciates you and respects you? And it's easier to do that as a traveler when Ashland has it too, actually, when there's a sort of a sense of pride. You know, all the Shakespeare, all over, you know, every motel and hotel I've stayed in here has some bard representation.
Or some lion or something that says,
exactly,
British or Shakespeare. Yeah.
Some shield. But, you know, that helps me to locate myself and to appreciate you more. So I think his emphasis is really smart.
But which raises a question. I do want to get to gentrification eventually. Mm-hmm. But even before that, I mean, you discussed some cities having, I mean, they've made the decision to go ahead and improve themselves and pull together as more of a community. But they have what you call a pinata problem, which I found fascinating.
The pinata problem is when you have, you know, well, specifically in Wilmington, you had, you know, this city here, and then you have Dow's and DuPont's, literally, of those chemical companies on the outskirts. And you sense, like, one of the things you could do, apparently, was take a school trip out to the sculpture garden at one of the estates, whether it was Dow or DuPont, I'm not remembering. And so, you know, for a day, you could go to these wonderful places. Well, now they have a riverfront that the Dow's and DuPont's and all sorts of corporations have donated to, with museums and certain features that all of these families have donated to. So every day a family can have a lifestyle experience of the city. So back in the day when you could just go for one day to this fancy place, I called that the pinata problem, which is that you have this beautiful pinata full of candy and it's hanging overhead, which is kind of an insult, like, we got all the candy. When you see that broken open into a city, it's a beautiful thing. And you just feel like that's better for everybody, including the very wealthy, because being isolated is being isolated, whether it's by your wealth or by your, you know, mental issues, or it doesn't allow a flow. So some of this wealth being poured into Wilmington allowed a flow as well of people into the city as well, so that people could look at each other and find one another.
Wilmington, Delaware, we're talking
Wilmington,
about.
Delaware, yeah, sorry.
Be clear which of the many Wilmingtons there are.
True.
But, you know, the part about the riverfront I found really interesting, particularly hearing that members of your traveling band will go to a waterfront first, which is so different from what it was like 40 years ago. Oh, don't go down to the docks, you know. You know,
no.
So now people actually flock to waterfronts because they're cool places to be.
You know, it's one of these things where, and, you know, this can be bipartisan because it was during Nixon's time, and Nixon was a big advocate, President Nixon. The Clean Water Act really made a difference. And so we have waterways that we can take advantage of, and they're incredible for wayfinding and for people to find their, you know, and they're safe. As I've discovered, when you're jogging along a waterfront, if somebody's created a path for you, and so many cities have now, you have people seeing you from the water, from across the water, from the path and from the road next to the water. So as a diminutive woman who doesn't know different neighborhoods, the waterfront is always just this destination. And yeah, my guys always put on their running shoes and jump off the bus and say, where's the waterway? So it's a wonderful thing to take advantage of. Even if it's a creek, I tell people, just clear it off. Just get rid of the brambles and do something fun. Unless you're protecting some, you know, beautiful salamander, then keep the brambles. But
or if it's a super fun site. You point out the CRS, well, combustible river syndrome.
Yes, combustible river syndrome was such a thing. And, you know, we knew it from Cleveland. But Cleveland wasn't the worst offender. And Cleveland kind of got the short end of the stick. We really have this, we have a lot of other examples in the Hudson River, where I live. And now there are places, you know, you don't necessarily want to eat a lot of fish from the Hudson River, but you can eat fish from the Hudson River. We did the work as citizens and as governments and as the relationship between the two. And there's a lot to be found there in the water and alongside of it.
Let's take a call here. We have Peter in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dar Williams, the author of What I Found in 1,000 Towns.
Hi, thanks for another good show. I am, I'm noticing how much I've read and heard stories on this really in the last couple months, and really rather around the world, whether it's in the British Isles, Spain, Venice, where where tourism has overwhelmed them to the point that it's just a disaster. And I'm from Colorado originally, and when I go back there, you know, it reminds me of the, you know, the back in the 60s or 70s there, where there was the Indian that was sitting on the cliff looking at the water.
Oh, that famous public service announcement.
Yeah, and seeing the trash in the water. And, you know, and you can't even hike in the mountains without, it's just a disaster. And so our property, which is, you know, at one point was in the sticks, is now, we find ourselves in this predicament where at the same time we're saying, how can we cater to this, all this money that's down on the Front Range, and bring some of that up here, you know, 250 miles away, where it's peaceful, quiet, beautiful views, all this stuff. But at the same time, you know, we don't really want to, we don't want to see it turn into what Aspen has become, you know.
Right, so not get overrun and not get gentrified in the process. Thanks for that, Peter.
Yeah, no, and you know, there's this tipping point, and I think tipping point is a great, you know, thing for us to know, because people try to improve their towns. I mean, I love this idea of having tourism as a way to improve, you know, to fill the coffers, to, you know, show your natural beauty. That also shows a lot of natural beauty to your citizens. It helps create a sense of place and cohesive identity. And then there's this tipping point that's really vast and sudden, you know, where people are, you know, where you feel overrun. And so my experience, because our town is experiencing that as well, what I found is that towns that try to improve themselves, they're building something called social capital. So you have your financial capital and you have your political capital. Then you build the social bank account of goodwill and people knowing each other and knowing, this is the shy one, but she's a great graphics designer. This is the really antisocial one, but he's a great sound guy. You know the skill sets, and you start to know what your town is and what it can hold and what it can bear and what it's ready to do. And it's through that social capital that tipping point can be handled if you don't panic, and that you say, okay, we know each other, we respect each other, we know our skill sets. Let's bring that into this thing called local government, which is just us. And, you know, maybe bring in a planner who's seen this before, who can say, okay, really, the cars are the worst problem. The litter is the next problem. People wearing the wrong footwear, that's the terrible problem. You know, not having resources that benefit you, like coffee shops and bookstores where they can bring their money instead of just a bunch of plastic keychains. You know, you got to pay attention to how you can capitalize on their on this income stream. There are people who can come in and sit beside you and say, how are we going to do this? The thing that I learned that might be valuable to you, Peter, is that in Moab, this guy Robin, who runs a bike company, said, we are all having to face change, but we can manage it. So instead of saying, I embrace change like a hippie, you know, but at not really controlling it, that's going to be a problem. Resisting change isn't going to work. Because it's going to happen. Managing change means staying calm enough to learn from these places that feel overrun, looking at the people around you, that social capital, caring about each other and yourselves enough to say, how are we going to manage this to our best benefit? You know, better trash. You know, we put trail stewards at the bottom of our trails because people were showing up in flip-flops from Brooklyn. And the trail stewards now are, there was one summer where there were no calls, no 911 calls, because they said, don't go up the trail, go to get a beer, man. Or they said, don't.
They could get injured in their flip-flops.
Yeah, they get injured and they get lost and they get freaked out. And a flip-flop is kind of a sign that says, I don't know what I'm doing here. So, you know, these trail stewards were incredibly, and it was an expenditure, but it was just, you know, a couple of lovely, low-paid ranger workers, you know, every three-day weekend. And everything improved with that information system in place. And it's still really crowded, and we're still dealing with it. But we have to manage it, because people are coming to freshwater swimming, hiking trails. People are falling in love with our country and wanting to see the terrain of our country. And I believe in my heart that they want to do it respectfully. And we as places that host tourists can encourage them to do that as well.
It's not just a tourism, as you point out. I mean, things like in Phoenixville, where they lost all the steel jobs. I have to wonder, though, about those places like that, where they've been, there's a lot of poverty, a lot of crime, drug use, perhaps. I mean, if people can't see past the immediate problems, can they move to the points of community that you're talking about here?
Well, there's, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, it's like, you know, starting a fire with sticks, you know, rubbing sticks together. I mean, it can seem very futile. And there are places where it's soggy sticks, you know, the system is working against them. And I do believe that there is, you know, systemic, you know, there's a classism to things in terms of, you know, some places and people can't get a break. They can't start. They can't get a job because they can't get a car and the car breaks down and that kind of, you know, writ large into communities. The question is, do you have a library? Yes, usually. You know, do you have some kind of kooky person who is talking about what are we going to do in this town? Do you have someone who can come plant some flowers along a shoulder? I know that sounds a little Pollyanna-ish, like a little do-goody, but, you know, planting flowers in a little rubbly place and then the flowers grow and you say, who did that? That can help. It shows a certain I care. Let's
Somebody
grow something
cares,
here.
Yeah.
And it's infectious. I don't mean to sound so like I kind of am embracing my skepticism because I feel like skepticism helps me respect towns and how they don't necessarily just want to go out and hug each other. But plant some flowers around your mailbox or around, you know, or do a guerrilla sunflower planting in front of this, you know, in a rubbly, you know, bend and see what happens. Start with wherever you see a little bit of heat and see if you can build the heat. And then if you feel the system pushing back, you push back and say, don't do that to us, system. Let's find one another so that we can tell the system where it can go.
Some really fascinating concepts in the book. What I Found in 1,000 Towns, A Traveling Musician's Guide to Rebuilding America's Communities, One Coffee Shop, Dog Run, and Open Mic Night at a Time. Dar Williams, thanks so much for your time, your music, and your attention.
Thank you, Jeffrey.